So I signed up for Tuple.
Yeah. Have you used it?
No, I haven't used it yet. It's in beta. It's in live beta. Ben likes to pre-launch, pre-launch things. I do miss Screen Hero though.
You know, I've been using Slack.
Yeah.
It's not
preparing.
It's not that bad. Yeah.
Do you have control?
Yes. The other person can give you control.
But it's not like all time. It's not like all the time you have control. You have to go back and forth.
No.
The person can give you control and then both
you
people
have control. Yeah.
Can you type?
Yeah. By default, you have a little pencil and you can draw things. And then if they give you control...
You can draw pictures?
Yeah.
So
I'm professional.
Do you type... You've typed like code into the editor?
Oh, yeah.
And it's fast enough?
Yeah. Right? I mean, it's image, you know, video sharing. So there is a lag. And then I always fat finger things, but then I don't see it for, you know, 5 seconds
because
of the lag, and it's a disaster.
Right.
So it's easier for me to just yell, open bracket, semicolon.
I was actually wondering if... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say... Go ahead.
I was wondering if there's like a tool here for local pairing. Because even sometimes when you pair locally, there's friction.
Yeah, I think what you want... So I've also used Adam's Teletype, which lets you share the editing session so you can see files the other person is opening. But it wasn't that good. Sometimes like my pairing partner would open a file and they'd say like, oh, did you see that I opened it? So the fact that you're asking that is kind of like an indicator that...
Uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, and it makes you like think, oh, I got to ask.
Yeah,
because it probably didn't open.
Right.
I was thinking what you really want is, you want to share like the Adam session.
Right.
The browser and then like video and audio.
Right.
I don't need video the whole desktop.
Right.
So there's got to be like some text format for both the browser and the editor.
That's lower bandwidth. That can be faster.
Yeah.
Interesting. Sometimes even when we pair locally, it's like, oh, no, this is what I mean. And then it's like, oh, why don't you just drive? But then it's kind of like a weird, you know, it'd be nicer if both people had a keyboard, let's say, something like that.
Yeah.
Sharing a monitor, maybe.
There's
I'm sure there's
plenty of room to improve pairing.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. What do you want to talk about today?
Let's see. I've been working on some fast boot stuff that I can talk about, kind of like where we left off last week's conversation.
Right.
And then we did like reader listener questions, and we got some good ones.
Nice.
That I think can fill the episode.
Let's pick up with the fast boot stuff. You weren't having nightmares all week, actually. You weren't having, it's the first time in months you haven't had a fast boot nightmare.
I don't know about that. So I'm working on making our app fast in Fastboot. So just rendering it in Fastboot.
Just making Fastboot fast.
Making our app fast in Fastboot.
Right.
So I ran into an interesting problem earlier this week where we are using a third-party library for drag and drop. It's called Dragula. And this thing is on NPM. You can NPM install it and then app import it in your Ember CLI build.
Mm-hmm.
This JavaScript library is third-party JavaScript library. Excuse me.
This third-party JavaScript library.
Say that 10 times fast. This third-party JavaScript library has references to document. So they set up some things. They test some stuff on document. They do things like they create a variable and assign like document.create element to this variable. So then they can just call like create in all their code.
Oh, interesting.
But this gets this JavaScript all gets executed when you include the module. So it works fine in Ember. But in Fastboot, you know, as soon as you try to reference document or document.create element, you're going to get an error.
Can I pause you there?
Yeah.
So that what's his name? Ryan Dahl, creator of Node?
Yeah.
He had that talk this last week, right?
I haven't listened to it.
So it was a talk about like his top 10 regrets for Node. Just saying some design decisions that he made that he wouldn't have. And one I remember was like the different environment in Node and not having something like a window in a document. And he was actually saying, this is like a clever thing that I did because like there is no window, there is no document. But at the end of the day, it created too much of an impedance mismatch. And the reality is, like, you're running JavaScript, and like JavaScript is made to run in the browser. So you want to carry over as much of that mental model of working in JavaScript as possible, because every little paper cut between the two is just an extra thing. And like, it might make logical sense to say there's no window or document in the server, but he was saying at the end of the day, it would have been better to have it.
That's super interesting. When I hear you say that, I think like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, but I've never once thought, man, you know what Node really needs is a
document window. Global.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
So anyways, why don't you pick it back up?
So basically, how to deal with this problem? Because as soon as you require this thing, as soon as you do import Dragula from Dragula in the module system, it's going to eval that code. It's going to reference document, and then Fastboot throws an error. And when Fastboot throws an error, it doesn't render the page. I think it renders like as much as it can up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then so it sends like half a rendered page to the client. And then the client takes over and renders. So it looks bad.
Yeah.
Not only that, but it fills the Fastboot output with a bunch of errors.
Right.
So, you know, I couldn't figure out how to, like, how do you go about this? Do you not, you have to import this module.
Yeah.
So
drag and drop.
Yeah, this is a drag and drop library. There's a deeper problem here that it's anything that you install from NPM,
yeah,
and you put in the module system, and that thing is a browser JavaScript library. It references document, it references window.
Right.
And there's tons of, I mean, go search NPM for things that reference window. There's tons of stuff.
Is there an init function here where we initialize it, or when is it? My initial reaction when you're talking that is like, that's only something needed for user interaction. It's not needed for initial render. So you would like lazily initiate it in a component or something?
So we do, I mean, we do initialize it in the component. The issue is that when you import Dragula from Dragula,
uh-huh,
it evals the script, and they have those helpers at the top of the script that do let create equal document dot create element. So they're basically creating a bunch of helper functions up top.
So you'd have to somehow asynchronously load that part of the JavaScript packet, like that part of your application.
Sure, but then it's like, you know, this,
because it's not too much of a stretch to say things that are user interaction, delay them because they're not needed for Fastboot. Like, that's not a bad programming model.
Of course, of setting up the event listeners,
right,
and
right,
all that,
right,
absolutely.
Right.
But I don't want to do something, I want to, at the top of my file, like this thing
is
meant to be used.
Yeah, it's a static import.
Yeah, it's meant to be used as a static import.
Yeah.
When you read the docs, it's...
Yeah.
Import, you know, thing from module. So
interesting. So how do you deal with it?
So this is fun. So the Fastboot has a recommendation for dealing with this class of problem. And it's, you write a Broccoli, I'm not sure what the term is, a Broccoli filter plugin that will basically, you will identify these parts of your application that are browser JavaScript, and you put them all into one tree, or all into a broccoli tree, and then you map over that tree and you wrap all that JavaScript with type of Fastboot is undefined, then you can run this code. And that way it prevents browser JavaScript from getting evaled in Fastboot land.
So you had to do that, and you had to say, like, you had to whitelist the import from Dragula and say that part?
I basically took that import, brought it into its own tree,
yeah,
and then wrapped it in that.
So you have two different builds of the app for...
No, it's all one build. It's just that when that thing ends up in your final vendor.js file, it's wrapped in a if type of...
But you can't do that with ES6 imports, can you? So it's only working because of, like, it gets compiled to, like, AMD?
Yeah,
I don't think you can do it if...
You app done.
True.
So it's a browser module,
yeah,
on NPM.
Yeah.
So you app dot import it.
Yeah.
So in Ember CLI build, it's app dot import node modules Dragula.js.
Yeah.
But
that's not the code that gets put in the if block. It's
right.
The import statement.
Right. So it's you basically bring it into a tree.
Yeah.
Wrap it, and then that thing gets imported. You basically import that thing. I think there's like Tree for Vendor. There's some
You wrap the module.
Yeah.
So the import is still there. It's always imported.
The import.
But then the thing that gets import has to be there.
Yeah.
But then the thing that gets imported is itself wrapped in an if block.
Yeah.
I see. So that way is a black box to you. And okay, interesting.
It's very interesting. Now also too, actually this wasn't enough.
Okay.
Because when you wrap that thing in a if block, now in fastboot, you know, does the transpiles your import statements to like require JS, whatever it is.
Yep.
Well, now the thing you're importing has been like if'd away. So fastboot gets an error like cannot find module.
Yeah.
So it's basically there's the if block, and then you do else, and you do like an empty define.
I see.
It's like else define no
op. I see. And then if you try to obviously use this in fastboot, you'd run into problems.
Right.
But that's just something you need to know as an application developer.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't, like, it's a drag and drop library, and it's, you know, you can't use drag and drop in fastboot
because
it's all setting up event listeners
and all that
stuff. Yes, I think, like, if I could snap my fingers, like, the ideal state is there's, like, you import some module, and that module, if you try to like call anything on that module in fastboot, it like throws an error like, this is a browser library, please don't use this in fastboot.
But otherwise it would take care of all that wrapping stuff. It wouldn't.
Yeah. And this made me think, like, this is kind of a problem for like adopting third party JavaScript in Ember, because we now have to think about, you know, it's not just about NPM installing things that you know, into node modules and then importing. We now have to think about, do they have these browser references?
Right.
And then, I don't know, there's another thought I had, is like, maybe Dragula like shouldn't be referencing this stuff.
Right.
But at the end of the day,
it will be.
It's a browser JavaScript library.
It's okay for it to make that assumption.
Yeah.
Interesting. Sometimes the Ember wrappers of packages are actually like a good thing, in the sense that we're working under a set of constraints that is narrower than a general quote JavaScript application, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a trade-off here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to think, I can't use this library because
there's no Ember wrapper.
There's no Ember package.
Right.
Yeah. And then also too, you want, you know, as an Ember developer, you don't want that friction of when, like, I go to a library's doc site, I just want to use it how that library
tells me. The APIs of the docs, I won't be cut out from that. I think there's a good way to do this, and I agree that you should be able to use the node module, and I think we're getting there to a point where you can. But if you're doing, like, a fastboot application, you need to be aware of that. I also think that Ember add-ons that wrap packages can be done in such a way that they actually provide more value. So it's not about that I have to use an Ember add-on that wraps X library. It's that I could use X library, or I could use Ember Moment, because not only is it going to just do the imports for me, it's going to do some other things that likely you'll want to do if you're using Moment in an Ember app, or like with same with Dragula.
It gives me a template helper.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So
I agree with you, but I also think there is not an unlimited amount of people taking every JavaScript library and making Ember packages for it.
Right. So you have to be able to you have to have access to it if you just need it, and there's no one who's done the work for you. But I do think there is room here for like education on how to make a good wrapper add-on.
Yes.
Because that's something that really affects your experience as a developer.
Which is a great segue into my next topic.
Okay.
So I'm very guilty of this, and also two times this week I tried to use Ember add-ons that wrap third-party packages, and those underlying third-party packages, I can't say third-party today. Those underlying third-party libraries, their API changes, or they evolve in a way, or an example is like Ember provides a service that you inject, and that's your interface. But then when you're reading like the doc sites of these third parties, there's no mention of the Ember service. They tell you to do code like this, and you don't have like a
clean... Using the X global.
Yeah.
Call methods off the X global, and you're like, I have a service. Is it the X global? Does it proxy the X global? Can I easily pass methods through to the X global?
So I think, in both times I tried to use these wrappers, and they both...
You got stuck.
They both got it wrong.
Yeah.
And it's not like the... Like, they're dumb, they get it wrong. Like, this stuff is really, really hard to get right.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's almost like I want...
But there are patterns. I mean, there are people who have done it successfully. Again, Ember Moment, you have access to Moment and you can go straight there. Yep. And then it's like, if you want some sugar for commonly used things, we're going to do that. And as people use... As people are like digging into the moment to do this thing, we could pull it out and add sugar on top.
100%.
I think that's the right approach.
Yeah. I think when you're starting to make one of these Ember wrappers, you don't want to go all in
yes.
on...
You don't want to restrict the interface.
Here's a bunch of components. Here's a service. Like you just... Yeah, I think
totally
you
agree.
You want to expose... You want to build up. You want everything yes. to decompose.
Yes.
So you want to say, here is the underlying API... Basically, I was thinking about it, and you know, if I find myself wrapping third-party libraries, I'm going to think, like a question I'm going to be asking myself is, how can I make it so someone can start using the official docs of this
right.
library as soon as possible?
Right.
And the quicker I can get to there, that's,
yep.
that's probably
yep.
better.
Totally. Well, I was thinking about that because it's the same with, like, we've been working on Ember CLI Tailwind, and it's the same thing. You want people to use the how do I do this in Tailwind? You want to go to Tailwind site.
Yeah.
But you want it to be obvious how it maps to the Ember side.
Yeah. Actually, the Tailwind work is a great example because this is kind of, it's outside of the scope of what's in Tailwind, where it's the broccoli stuff.
Yeah, the broccoli. Yeah, and the style guide. Yeah. And that's all stuff that makes it more valuable, but you still are not restricting any use of the features of Tailwind at all. So, and when we started Mirage, it was the same thing. I mean, originally it wrapped Pretender, and you just had like a this.pretender pretender that you got, which was a direct pass through to all of Pretender's APIs. And over the years, Pretender has gotten new APIs that Mirage either has never built into its own API or just, yeah, it's never done that. But you could always access them, like handle the requests and stuff. You just get it through Pretender. But then when enough people started using things, that's when we started adding more APIs to Mirage.
Yeah.
So I think the pattern is there. It is easy to lock yourself, to do it in a way where you're locking people out. And that's what you always want to be aware of. If you want to say, I'm wrapping library X. Okay, first step, make it available as easy as basically Ember install my thing, and then that person has X wired up in their app, and now they should be able to access X and all of its APIs. And if I start adding sugar on top of it for common use cases, I need to think, okay, in a month from now, when library X gets a new API, can the users of my add-on, my wrapper, get it?
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, it's hard. I'm like I said, I'm really guilty of this. You're
yeah.
like, I'm going to provide this awesome
yeah.
declarative interface
right.
with all these contextual
right.
components.
Right.
And so it's really, it's just, you know, it's kind of like this week being like the end user of this.
You were
and just wanting,
on the receiving end of a bad abstraction.
Yeah. And
it's really bad because if you don't control it, it's not like bad abstractions in our applications are bad because they're hard to back out of and they lock you in. Bad abstractions with a library like this is even worse because you don't control the source code and now you literally are stuck.
Yep.
So
yep. It's hard. It's you know, you're reading, what it came down to for me was I'm reading like this documentation site and I'm like, okay, that's exactly what
right.
I want. And then I have to mentally map
right.
over to how to do that.
Right.
Yeah. It's almost like just, it's just this reminder that, you know, you're building an Ember add-on and there's all these awesome tools that Ember gives you. And it's like, you have to really fight not to use those.
Yeah. I think the obvious like challenge that someone could make here is, you know, there shouldn't be an Ember wrapper to any of these things.
Yes.
And we should just compose together node modules. I think that takes it too far. And I think the reality is that because we're on a shared infrastructure like Ember CLI, these things actually can provide more value.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is, like you said, is doing it in a way that doesn't cut you off. So
Moment is a really
good
example.
Moment is a good example.
And that works so well. So we can, this pattern works.
Yeah. Exactly. Cool. Good lesson. Something I want to talk about was some of the testing stuff I was doing in Broccoli Land as well. So I was working on Ember CLI Tailwind because we're doing the Tailwind video series and, you know, series-driven development. Like, it's good. You end up staying up all night to try to get something working so you can make a video on it the next day. We had Ember CLI Tailwind working and it pulls in, like, post CSS and it wires up Tailwind and it runs all that stuff through your Broccoli build and it rebuilds when, like, the files change. But we had to have some configs set and it was because... This is another thing, by the way, that I think is good about the add-on abstraction, which is we started Ember CLI Tailwind as an easy way to package up Tailwind for an Ember app. And almost immediately, someone was like, I'm using this in my add-on. make these changes so that it can work. And then like we made it work with add-ons. So already you're thinking about that use case before I had it even come up for me. Whereas like if you just had to install the raw Tailwind and wire up PostCSS into your build, think if you were just, if you didn't have the shared infrastructure and you're like, oh yeah, this works, but now you want to share it and someone else can consume it and modify it. You're not, that's like, that's a hard, it's very hard, like add-ons and transitive dependencies, all that stuff is very hard. So the fact that we have really good patterns because of our shared infrastructure, I think is a good thing.
So are you saying by you being forced to build this in an add-on, you automatically get to back out how this gets used in other add-ons as
well? I'm thinking about that, whereas I wouldn't have before. And this, again, it's not that I'm forced to make an add-on wrapper, because Tailwind's official site has instructions for setting it up in a build environment on Node, which Ember is, even though it's something, it's not Webpack, but it's still a build environment that can run Node modules like PostCSS. So you can wire it up according to the Tailwind instructions, and that would be the end of it.
Now, when you say that, it's you install like PostCSS and wire it up with PostCSS, or are you writing Broccoli stuff?
Well, you do have PostCSS. We have PostCSS, an Ember add-on for PostCSS. Okay. So you would just install that, and then you would npm install the Tailwind Node module, and then register that them. with. It would be exactly the same as if you were already working with like Vue or a React app.
Okay, so you're not writing Broccoli.
Okay. This is like Ed's video was about this, setting up Tailwind. I'm almost certain you're not writing Broccoli. You have to do some configuration in your build layer. So, but I think because we had a PostCSS add-on, you can do it all in that file.
I think that's right.
Okay. But basically the point is like you can wire up a Node module in your build process and have it work. I wanted to make the Ember CLI Tailwind add-on for a couple of reasons. One, it's like, again, as an Ember developer, you're like, when you can just Ember install and the thing works, it's an amazing experience. And I knew it could be that. And it also can do all these other cool things like build a style guide for you that is not going to come if you just wire it up yourself. So that's kind of why I went for the add-on. And but because of that, people were already bringing up, how do I use this in my add-on? So how do I use this as part of my thing, which is a dependency of other Ember apps? And so then you're thinking, how am I going to architect this, the infrastructural parts of it, such that it will work in any case? So I think that's really cool, because that's how we get to the higher levels, where you're like, I'm building an add-on, like add-on docs or my component library, and I want to use Tailwind to style this piece. So I'm going to install Tailwind and it's going to work. And then like you're building your Ember app and you do the same thing, and you don't know that there's all this stuff going on under the surface. I think that's pretty amazing. So we had already added that functionality to Tailwind, and you had to specify some config. So it required that you say whether you're doing one thing or the other. I mean, it's still easier than having to wire it up, but you still had to say like my build target was app, or my build target was dummy, which means I'm using it to style the dummy app of my add-on, or my build target was add-on, which means I'm using it to style the components in my add-on that I intend to ship to a host application.
What about engines? Do engines have a different?
I don't know. I think someone asked about them. Engines are add-ons, so I'm not sure if it works with engines right now. But again, that's another case that might come up eventually, and it would be great. I mean, the library should support it, right? Mm-hmm. Also, it works in Fastboot. Like, that came up soon, too. So now anyone who Ember installs Ember CLI Tailwind gets a Fastboot-compatible, add-on-compatible, app-compatible integration story with Tailwind, which is pretty awesome. Nice.
So we need to clone, like, you a million times and then just right. Send you off an NPM.
Right, exactly. So I wanted to automate that part, because that was the one config option that you had to specify. And again, thinking about API design, I'm an Ember user, I'm installing an Ember add-on, like convention over configuration, right? So I should just be able to, we understand your file structure, we understand whether you're developing an app or an add-on, whether you've put your Tailwind file and your config in an add-on folder or a test dummy folder. And so we should be able to derive the build target from the files on disk. And again, another example of a benefit we have from being on the shared 10th floor. And so that's what we wanted to do. But we wanted to do it in a way that was like test driven. Like, we wanted to make sure we had tests for this. And I hadn't done a bunch of that kind of work before. So that took some time. but it was fun. It was interesting learning about it. So basically the idea is like, how can you test that given an Ember application with a Tailwind directory under app, when I run Ember serve or Ember build my app, then I end up with, you know, a vendor or a tailwind.css file in my final build that uses the config values from my thing. So that's like what you want to test. And if you think about that, that's like, I'm never going to write a test for that.
I'm just thinking about how I would test this, and I would shell out all these commands outside of Node, and then I'd open the final, I'd open the build at the end and search for some string that I'm expecting.
Exactly. So there's basically this package called Broccoli Test Helpers, which lets you do basically that. And it's really cool. And I found out about it just from code search on Ember Observer and some folks pointing me in the right direction on the Ember Discuss forum.
Code search on Ember Observer is great because that wrapping fastboot thing.
Yep.
Once I saw that, I saw that.
Once you knew what to Google for.
I saw that in a gist somewhere. And I was like, I wonder if other people are doing this.
Yep.
And I used code search. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. So that's how I came across this Broccoli Test Helpers. And the idea there is, you get to, because Broccoli works with the file system, that's exactly what you want to do. You want to say, given this file system, when I do this, then here's the output file system.
So does this test take like a minute to run? Like, are
you watching? It takes a long time. You have to bump up the timeout. At least I did, but I wanted to just get it working. And then if it was prohibitively slow, figure that out later.
Absolutely.
But it works, and it takes like a second or something like that, or a second and a half. It's not that fast.
Wait, that's not.
The timeout is like 2 seconds, 2,000 milliseconds. So.
Okay, I thought this was going to be like, you know, when I run Ember build, it takes.
I think it does. I think some of the boundaries, they're cutting it off to make it a little bit faster, but it is creating a builder. So you can like import create temp and create builder from Broccoli Test Helpers. You can create a temp directory in like a managed location, which is the way Broccoli works, right? It like creates managed temp directories. And then you can use that as like the beginning of your funnel. So you can start writing to that thing. So you create temp, you have an input location, and then you can do like input.write file, and you can start like writing files to it. And what they have is this thing called Fixturify, which, so you create the temp directory and then you want to write like an Ember application to it, right? And then you want to run your logic, like your Broccoli plugin logic or your add-on logic on that directory and see what comes out. So what you could do is you could just, in like your add-ons test directories under like fixtures, you could just create a new folder called app with Tailwind. And that would be a directory. And then you would just have a folder structure that represents a new app with
Tailwind. So it's almost like you went in there and you did Ember init.
Basically like that. But you don't need everything. You need like a minimal reproduction of it, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say you had all those files in this test fixtures directory in your add-on. Then your test will create the temp directory. And then you can just do like file system node. You can just like copy this thing and write it to temp.
Oh. So you can do different configurations of Tailwind.
Exactly.
Nice.
Exactly. So you write it to temp. And then you run your thing on this as the input. And then you can do await output.build, input.build is the output. And then you have output.files. And it's just like a JSON object representing a file structure. It's a JSON object representing an entire directory. So it's keys and objects, where the keys are the names of the directory. And the objects are a hash with all the files and directories in it. And it's just a nested tree structure. And
is there thing that's a contents of the file?
Well, yes. If it's a file instead of a directory, the value of the key is just the string of the contents.
So when you run your assertions, you don't even have to worry about, okay, how do I open this file?
Exactly. You just say, I expect output.files.assets.dummy.css to exist and to contain this customized value based on the input Tailwind config in my thing.
Nice.
Super cool. And there's even another helper that's called Fixturify, which goes between that format of that object and the file structure and the actual directory structure on disk. So given like a tree, given that sample application, you could call Fixturify on the root and you would just get a JavaScript object in memory representing everything in that subdirectory.
Could you then mutate that JavaScript object?
You can go back and then rewrite it or anything. So actually what it turns out is that, you know how I said you need like, we need a fixture to write a test against app with Tailwind. And then we kind of create almost like Ember init there. but you really just need a minimal set. And like making all those files is annoying. So instead what you do is you use a JavaScript object with like app, colon, templates, colon, empty thing, and then like config, environment, and then you can just do a JavaScript object. So you can represent like an Ember app as a JavaScript object and then call Fixtureify on it and write it to the input helper. So it makes it really easy to like create many different scenarios of Ember apps with different configurations of their files.
You can do it in code instead of having to do it on disk.
Exactly. Nice. So imagine we wanted to do, give me an Ember app with this file or this configuration or this and that. So like all the boring parts that are the same, they're in the JavaScript object, but then I did the Tailwind config as actual files because I want to see like if someone actually created a file called colors.js and specified this color, here's what I would expect to find.
Pretty cool.
Pretty amazing. So basically, you now have a way, if you're making an add-on that uses the file system as part of its API, which if you think about it is, like even Mirage does this, right? Like the way you create a serializer in Mirage is by creating a file under Mirage serializers. So now you can write a test for that. Given a file, Mirage serializers, then once I'm in my app, I would expect to be able to call serialize on this thing. That would be a test that everything's wired together.
And this is really testing the interface.
Yes.
Nice.
So really, really cool stuff. So those tests were great. We got them in and we covered the build target config stuff. So I got all those tests passing. So I knew the behavior worked. And then I built the feature, which was obviously like two lines change that said, instead of reading build target, read the file system. If I find app/tailwind directory, I know I'm building for an app. If I find add-on/tailwind, I'm building for an add-on. If I find test dummy tailwind, I'm building for a test. So I made that change, removed the build target configuration, all the tests passed, shipped 0.6. And now you can just Ember install Ember CI tailwind and everything is just set up for you.
Nice.
Pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Should we do
some listener questions?
Yeah. Should we call this anything? Mailbag?
Mailbag? I like mailbag. Ask Ember Map.
There's a few good ones. Luke Melia asked this one. Speeding up Ember's build. Speeding up the build of an Ember app. I feel like I've been working on this for like the last few months.
Okay.
And like this has come up a lot. So I have like all these like little points that
interesting. I think can, okay. Yeah, can help you. I don't.
So some of them are like really obvious and I just took some notes, but Windows. So we were working with a client that they do all their Ember development on Windows, and building on Windows is really slow by default. So there's like this awesome Ember CLI Windows add-on. You can install that. It basically gives you all these tips. There's a guide for Windows. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's like kind of like the first thing that came to mind.
Right. Just because they are so different. The environments are so different.
Yeah. Not using Windows. So like newer versions of Windows have they come with like a Linux file system you can use. So that's going to speed it up tremendously. There's a persistent cache filter.
Persistent filter. Right. Yeah, there's a version of Broccoli filter that is persistent, and they started incorporating that into like a lot of the core Broccoli plugins.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's going to speed up initial build time, because the first time you build it from cold, we'll have to do everything. And then typically the way Broccoli works, as soon as you cancel the build, everything's discarded in temp. What this does is it takes the files that was built in temp and puts them in a permanent location somewhere, not permanent, but somewhere in temp that's persistent. And so when you run Ember Server again, it will pull those in. So that should really help.
Your old work, yeah.
Exactly. So if I was working on a really slow Ember app, I think the first thing I would do would be make sure you upgrade everything latest, first of all, because it does get better over time. The Broccoli builds seem to get better over time. And then I would look at the add-ons we're using, and if there's a big violator, you know, someone who is not using the persistent cache. I mean, I know when I spike on add-ons, and sometimes those spikes turn into like production add-ons, I'm just trying to get it working first, and I'm not really thinking about the caching stuff. So I'm sure a lot of folks end up doing that too.
I don't think I've ever manually done that for an add-on.
So. But if you're using some of the core Broccoli plugins, then you get that stuff for free.
Cool.
Like if you're using Map, if you ever use like Broccoli Stew and done like Map or Filter or anything,
yep.
Those things I think are smart enough to just use a persistent filter.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Another thing I've done is we have some, again, like node packages, like front end packages that are just installed in our app.
Yeah.
And they ship with like a whole bunch of code that we don't use.
So like the highlighter, syntax highlighter for one of our markdown things.
So we have the syntax highlighting and markdown. We use like Remarkable and Highlight.js. And by default, those packages just have every...
COBOL.
Yeah. Everything. Everything. So I took some time to basically make my own build of these browser third-party libraries, drop them in Vendor, and those took, not only did they speed up your build because you don't have to minify them and go through all that, but they also speed up your, they lower your file size.
That's awesome.
So just being aware of what's ending up, what third-party JavaScript is ending up there and see if there's like a way you can optimize it.
Yep, that's great.
And then another thing is there is a, you can do like Graph Viz with Broccoli. And so I ran this a few years ago. And I ran it this morning on Ember Maps app.
Okay.
So you can do, there's in the Ember CLI GitHub repo, there's like a documentation folder. And there's a thing called like performance.md or something like that. And it just has a whole bunch of commands you can run. It's really nice. There's a lot of awesome stuff in there.
Interesting. Where was that file?
It's somewhere. It's like user perf or perf.md. We'll put it in the show notes.
It's in the which repo?
It's in Ember CLI.
Ember CLI's repo.
Yeah. There's a folder with a bunch of markdown documents, and one of them is all about performance. So there's a bunch of commands you can run. One thing you can do is you can take your whole build and get it into GraphViz. So you can run Ember build and then basically get this giant chart that's how long every add-on, every little step of the process, how long everything took.
Oh, cool.
I mean, it's massive. The PNG that it generated was like 120 megabytes.
Oh my gosh.
It's just a massive, I mean, just every little thing that Broccoli does gets written there. I know they have some hooks too.
So was it not that useful? Like, could you see a couple that were bigger?
For just scanning it and like, oh, I wonder how our build is. It's not that useful. If you are like, holy shit, the build is too slow, it's causing a huge bottleneck and you can spend a few days.
Right.
It's probably worth it.
Right.
You can scan through this
right.
massive graph and find something.
Right.
What is that? Is like Heidemiel?
Heimdall.
Heimdall. That was close. Heimdall. I think that's hooked into Ember CLI. So I think you might be able to run like debug equals star and then Ember build and start to get some output there.
Oh, interesting.
So a lot of like Ember CLI, this performance stuff, like
there, a lot of it's wired in.
Yeah, there's not a lot of polish.
Yeah,
you know you're gonna get these massive files that you have to go through and debug. But I think there's a lot of
the info is there.
Yeah, it's there. Like someone clearly had this problem and they wired it up.
Interesting.
So yeah, we'll link in the show notes. But that markdown file in Ember CLI was super helpful. Looking through that.
That's awesome.
Next question is about the angle bracket polyfill and would we use it? Have you seen that, Roberts?
I saw it. I haven't looked at it yet. I haven't used it yet.
I poked around. I thought it was really cool, like really clever. It's one of those things that it's like, it's really clever. And then when you see it, you're like, oh, that's so obvious. Why didn't I think of that?
What does he do?
He does the AST helpers.
Oh, okay.
To rewrite angle brackets to component invocations.
Is it capital letters?
Yeah, capital letters.
And it can be one word?
Or
right now, too?
I think you need to be two words because it's going to get rewritten to a curly component.
Right.
So I think it needs to be two.
Right.
There was a feature in it that I really wanted. It was splatting. So you can do... And in a component, you can call a child component and pass it dot, dot, dot attributes.
Wow.
And it's going to get all the attributes of the
How would it component. Be able to do that at build time? I mean, what would it do at build time that would enable that feature for a normal Ember component?
I guess look at all the attributes that are, you know your parent component is being called with X,
oh, okay. Y, Z. Oh, interesting. And
take those. I don't know. I didn't. Yeah, look. Yeah, I don't. Yeah. I'm guessing.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Very cool.
I've needed this before. I have a component. I worked on an app that has a component that can render. It basically does some logic and then figures out another component to render. And the idea was it should just pass all the attributes that was given to this child component.
Right.
And I ended up like having to pass in like options. Yeah. It's like a hash. Yeah. And now you're in this other, you're in your child component. You have to be aware they can be called with options. So I saw that and I was like, damn.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Also, I've done that, needed that before for like link two, where you don't know if you have one or two or three models or a dynamic thing, then it would be great to be able to splat it.
Yes. Yep.
And then just take those splats, do your custom wrapper, but then render the normal link to with it and have it just work.
Yeah. So I will next time I come across this, I'll definitely try that.
It's awesome.
I think the question was like, would we recommend it?
Right.
And I think, you know, it's written by Robert. He's got a great track record.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking for an excuse to use this.
Right. So. Right. It's obviously still more risky than when it's finally in Ember proper, but, he probably thought about a lot of the implementation that he put out there. So
yeah, and to maybe give like a more straight answer, like I'm not using this now because I don't have a need for it.
Right.
So there's nothing that my app needs to do today that I can't do with curly components.
Right.
But when, you know, if I do come across like the splatting,
right,
that's when I would reach for this. And
cool.
Yeah.
And he did that on the back of another polyfill for an RFC he wrote, right? Which was the wasn't there two that he did recently?
Yeah, there's the, like, you can do the at names.
Yeah.
I think he's got a few of these.
Wasn't there something else that he did, another feature that he just released a polyfill for that was, like, a really cool feature coming to Ember? Named block. It wasn't named blocks or something like that? I guess not.
Yeah,
I guess it was.
So.
It was the angle brackets. What else is coming in, like, 3.4? Isn't there something?
At names.
It must be
attributes.
At names. Yeah, it must be that.
Cool.
Interesting. Cool.
This was a good question. I'm just going to rephrase it. Okay, so you're building an app with skeleton screens, and how do you, like, do you use a model hook in loading states? Do you use Ember concurrency and components? It feels like there's a few ways to do this. And sort of the question is, you know, I need to build this app. I know I want skeleton screens and loading screens.
Mm-hmm.
What approach should I take?
That is a good question.
I mean, I feel like we've done a whole bunch of different approaches.
Yes.
We've done the model hook with the loading template.
Right.
And then the components. You know, I think the last few times I've done this, I've used Ember concurrency inside of components. I think it's a bit easier to think about, you know, is task running, else do, you know, if it's running, show the skeleton, else show the data. The loading template, especially when there's like a pathless loading template, sometimes there's like a mental...
there's a bit of a jump there.
Yeah.
And
then we use pods.
Right.
And then the docs aren't always, they're for classic. And it's easy to get working in pods.
Yeah.
But there's just a lot of...
To me, the bigger thing is it's harder to get, if you wanted to split out, be smarter about the static parts of your template and the loading parts. If you have the outlet is here in the parent, and then you just make a loading template for it, it's going to be the whole thing. Whereas if you want to do that feed thing, you need to be strategic about where you put it, the outlet, and do like a pathless child route with the feed and have everything else be static. Whereas really, if you're looking at that, you want to see that template. Think about how you would describe the interface. You would say, up here it says the user's name, here are the four tabs for the pages, here are the filters, and then here's the data. If it's loading, you'll see a spinner. And that would be it. If you open a handlebars template that had the static stuff, and then it had if load users is running, spinner, else list a table, that seems to me the more natural expression of what it is you're building.
Yeah.
So
yeah, with a pathless child route, you have to come up with a new name.
Exactly. You're like route, feed, and then you're in a subroute, and it's just a little more confusing. My problem with that though is that, well, it feels like it sucks that right now there's these two ways to do it because it feels like you have to go one or the other, and one doesn't easily. You don't just opt into the simple complexity as you need it. because I like the idea of like starting with the model hook, and then it's like, oh, I need a loading, but now you have to like move it. I mean, it's not that bad. You just move the query from the model hook into the like, but then you need to probably make a component or put it on the controller. I mean, we do that a lot, put it on the controller and then use like UI hooks or did insert to fire it off. So that's pretty nice.
Yeah. I really like what something you just said, where if you have to break up the template, then use a component.
Right.
If you get the whole thing.
Then that's basically what I do, because the app I'm working on right now, it's the same thing. And the model hook and the loading template is so nice in the sense of it's a very constrained API and that works great. But at the end of the day, yeah, I think if I were writing like a really polished product and I knew I wanted a ton of control over the loading and everything, the Ember concurrency task gives you more control. I think the idea here also is like loading templates and stuff like that. It is more work. And at the end of the day, it's something that not every person does in every part of their app. So the loading template gets you there really fast. You just create the loading template, throw a UI spinner component in there, and like you'll improve your UX. However, if you want to do a really nice product, you should be thinking about the loading states just as much as you're thinking about the happy path and the error states. And in that case, an Ember concurrency task in the template, I think, is a nicer approach.
Cool. One thing, just to say this, one thing I never do is like an Ember concurrency task in the model hook.
Yeah.
So
why would you? I mean, yeah, the model hook is promise aware.
Yeah, I've seen that pattern. But yes, exactly. The model's promise aware.
I think if you're using the model hook, then you're saying I'm just doing it the Ember way, like the part of Ember that is giving us a pattern for data loading, we're just going to do it the way they do it, and they just return a promise. And then if we're going to do more, we're going to opt into the complexity of Ember concurrency. So
nice.
Great question. Should we
one more? Yeah. So this was a question about like this person is building a table with a whole bunch of data, and then each row in that table, you can do like CRUD actions. So you can edit the thing, you can delete it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking like, what's the best UI pattern for this? And they kind of brought up a few. They said like a cog that you click and it shows a drop-down menu for each row.
Yep.
They had said like, oh, just use icons. Like yep. There's icons in the row. And then also buttons.
Group.
Yeah, just a button group in each row. And they were just like, yeah, what's the best way
question. We're doing something similar in the app that we're working on too. We have basically the cog approach. It's like the three dots. I think Luke W. calls it the kebab menu.
Oh, yeah, the mystery
meat. Yeah, the mystery meat at mobile navigation. So you got the kebab, which is the three dots horizontal, and then you've got like the skewer, which is this one, and you got, of course, a hamburger. So the dots are nice, and you can hide them until the user hovers the row of the table, which is nice, because if you have 20 table rows up on the screen, and every single row has colored actions or that, it's distracting. Mm-hmm. So I really think with this kind of stuff, it's important to think in terms of the progressive disclosure, which is not presenting an action to the user until they need it. Slack does a very good job at this. So I think it, with stuff like this, when I'm working on problems like this, I just go and look at apps and try to copy stuff I see. Slack does a great job. If you put your mouse off of Slack and you look at it, you're gonna see a very clean interface. As soon as you start hovering things over things, a lot of elements are gonna appear. Dropbox Paper also does a phenomenal job of this. So if you look at Dropbox Paper, you basically see a full document. It's just text. And as you hover over the left side of the screen, you're going to see the table of contents based on auto-generated based on the headers. If you double-click a word, then you'll get the rich text editing, the bold and the italic pop-up. If you click on an empty line, you're going to see insert a Dropbox file, insert an attachment, all this stuff. And all that stuff is progressively disclosed to the user as they're using the app. So I think that's like the number one thing to think about.
That's such a good, that answer got me really, really excited about UI development, just the way you answered that. And then also I get to throw a curveball at you.
Okay.
Because he said that, you know, he does the cog normally.
Yeah.
But his users complained they hate that one extra click.
So that's the problem, I think. The problem is the extra click. I think if you hit it until they needed it, they wouldn't be upset. What I would do is just show all three buttons, let's say. So let's say you use icons and they're grayed out, and when you hover over them, you hover over a trash can, it becomes red. You hover over like a check, it becomes green for save or something like that.
I think
and that way the
Slack
hover
does this too.
Hover is not thought of as an action. A click and a swipe are thought of as actions. But you can even do something like I just was thinking of Trello also, by the way, does this very well, but you could hover over it. Let's say you hover over the menu, the row, and then it comes up with like a dot, dot, dot. And what they're going to do is they're going to hover. And when they hover over the dot, 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 it actually opens up. And then they just click. For them, that's not a separate action, even though it kind of is. It would be much less annoying than having to click and then click. So you can even have those things there and show them as the user gets close to them, so they only have to click once in their mind.
That's really cool.
So I think you could do that. I'm trying to think of, there was, like, I think Slack might even do this, or maybe even GitHub, where you have the issue and you see a bunch of circles of user avatars, and you're like, oh, who is that? And you hover over it, and it just opens up, and you can see everybody without having to click anything. So it, like, you hover and it kind of moves, and then you go away and it goes like this. So I think that's like key to this stuff. And I think yeah, the cog or the menu, you can open it without clicking on it. Or you could show the icons and go straight there. Also, like for this app that we're working on, it's important for the user to be able to do multiple things. So the annoying thing, they might say it's annoying to me because I have to click it twice. What really might be annoying is that they're having to go through and do this for a bunch of things. And what they'd really rather do is like select each row and then do a bulk action. So really the answer might be like be able to select multiple rows and do a bulk action. That might make them happier. So that's something where I would say watch the user use your app and figure out what they're doing with it. And then you can get the best UI there.
Nice. So, nice.
Cool.
It's an awesome answer.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for this today's episode. So if you like what you heard and you have a question of your own, I think the best place is to hit us up on Topic Ember Map in Slack or the Ember Map Twitter account, right?
Yep.
Awesome. So, yeah, we look forward to answering more questions, and we'll see you on the show next time. Bye.